Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 206, and we're going to talk about getting help when things go wrong. If you're out in the boonies and your motor ain't running, what are you going to do? We have some help. We're also going to talk about the specific kind of microwave that is best for your rig, a product review of something completely unexpected, and a tale from the road involving a really stupid truck trick that you should never, ever try. But I did, and I paid the consequences. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining me once again for episode 206. This episode, I took a bunch of suggestions from the folks in the Discord channel. So thanks to all of you who are in Discord and pop in from time to time. Repro especially was very helpful in providing these suggestions. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today comes from those folks. So if you are interested in Discord, Discord is a chat service, basically. We do have a server. The link is in the show notes, and it's very chill. There's not that much content. People just come in and ask questions, and folks answer them, and it's a very friendly place, and you are more than welcome. So let's dive right in here. Things do go wrong. And you can get stuck in the woods, and that can be very, very bad. In fact, I just watched a video of this guy who got stuck near Goler Wash. He ran out of gas in Death Valley, basically. Goler Wash is in Striped Butte Valley there. It's kind of a rough place to get across, but a lot of people go out there because it's near Barker Ranch, which is where they caught Marilyn Manson. The other Manson. What the heck was his name? Charles Manson. Woo! I am having a cocktail as I do this one today. You may notice some differences. That's okay. By the way, cheers. Anyway, Charles Manson. So there's a lot of traffic out there, but this guy went out there and ran out of gas right at Goler Wash. People found his truck, and it's been 8-9 months, and they haven't found him. And, I can tell you this, if he had followed the advice I'm about to give you, they would have found him, because I'll get to it. Anyway, first thing you should do, if you travel a lot, is have some kind of access to some sort of emergency road service. Now, this is the low-level kind of thing. You've got cell phone service, you've broken down somewhere that's usually on pavement, you know, normal type of stuff. I use AAA. I know there's a lot of mixed reports with AAA. I did a fairly long piece about AAA 150 episodes or so ago about how sometimes they'll tow your van and sometimes they won't, and that can be very frustrating. But I can tell you that personally for me, they have towed my ambulance van, very large van, in Chicago, and they towed my Winnebago in Oregon without any trouble at all. So I called and they answered and came and they did exactly what they said they would, so I have to give them some credit for that. Now, I do have the RV Plus plan. I think it's the most expensive plan or close to it, and that's something to consider. But it's a great thing to have. If you're going to get stuck, even if AAA can't help you, it's a number you can call where they will try to find you help. And sometimes that's what you really need. Of course, it goes without saying, if you have friends and family you can call, you will start with them. But this is for folks who are maybe hundreds and hundreds of miles away from their family. Number two, another thing that's very handy, and I use this with my wife, is Find My on the iPhone. Now, I'm an iPhone user. I know you Android folks have different stuff, and I just don't know what it is. But the concept is the same. Basically, my wife and I can stalk each other all we want. We have given our devices permission, and I can just say, you know, hey Siri, where is Jen, my wife, and it will tell me. And it's as simple as that. And what's actually telling me is, you'll need to unlock your iPhone first. You be quiet. It actually is telling me where her phone is or where her iPad is. It tracks actually the device. This is very useful because when I'm out in the boonies for a while, she can find out where I am. She doesn't have to call me and say, where are you, or anything like that. She can just look in the app and say, okay, he's halfway between where he's going or whatever. And if I ever went missing for any reason, she'd be able to see that, he said he was going to Texas, but this says he's in Idaho. Whatever. Now, you have to have a good relationship with your wife, but it's a handy thing that I think if you can, give somebody you trust permission to use Find My. And if anything does go wrong, that's just another safety measure. Number three, and back with the iPhone specificity here again, iPhones 14 and later can send emergency messages over satellite. That means if you're out in the middle of Death Valley and have no cell phone signal, which surprisingly, Death Valley is getting more and more cell phone signal, you can make an emergency call with your iPhone. And it actually uses the screen as kind of a satellite antenna. Now, I recommend everybody with a newer iPhone, 14 or 15, try this. See how it works. If you go in and initiate an emergency call, put your phone in airplane mode and go outside and initiate an emergency call. You'll see the instructions in the phone. Go through the process. Now, there's a test mode, so you can do this safely without bothering anybody. But do it and see how it is. And you basically have to line your phone up with the sky, and it'll tell you how good a job you're doing. So if you're in a cave, it's not going to work. If you're in a submarine, not much is going to work at all. But if you're outside and you have a fairly good view of the sky, this can work. And honestly, for me, I was considering getting what I'm about to talk about next, which was a little device that would do satellite communication. I no longer think I need that because I am not that far off the grid most of the time. And I think the iPhone is going to be good enough for me. So check into that. Right now, that is free. So you can use the service. The call is free. And caveat here. If you're in the U.S. and you use any of these SOS assistant devices that we're about to talk about, you can call somebody and they will come help you, but you're on the hook for the help. And that help could cost $100,000, depending on what it is. If they have to send a helicopter in there and there are people going to rappel down a mountain to get to you and haul you out in a stretcher, yeah, that's going to cost a lot of money. I recommend you don't care about that at that point. We're talking about saving your life here. But know that in the U.S., such services are billed to you. So this isn't something to use frivolously. I've been told that in other countries, it's covered. It's just part of the social services that they have that we don't have in the U.S. But in the U.S., yes. Now, one of the things, well, all right, let's get right into it. So number four is Garmin inReach, the Zoleo, the Spot. There's a number of these. Garmin inReach seems to be the most popular. And these are little devices that you carry that you can send text messages over satellite with them, and they have a special antenna. They're almost always connected to satellite. And I see a lot of people using these. I know Wonder Hussy has one. I know Foresty Forest has one. And they're out there, so I think that they should have them. Some of them have emergency modes, like they'll detect a fall, and like, you know, the Apple Watch does that too. These are great. The problem is the cost. Talking about at least $300 for a Garmin inReach. You can get the refurbished ones for a little bit less. Some of the other ones like the Spot are a little bit less money. But it's not that. It's not the one-time cost. It's the subscription costs. They can be quite expensive. And then there's a cost per message cost. So I'm not going to get into all the different plans. But if you are looking at a standalone device that will let you communicate no matter where you are, make sure you understand the plans. This is especially important if you're the kind of person who will go out on a big trip once a year or twice a year and you're not going to use the device the rest of the year. Some of these don't let you stop your plan, and that's bad. You're paying for this even though it's sitting in your drawer. So make sure you look at those. Discord chat turned me onto this thing I'd never heard of before, and it's called Bullitt. Now, this is number five. So that's Bullitt, spelled B-U-L-L-I-T-T. And apparently, this started off in Europe. And this is a little bit different. This is a satellite hotspot kind of a thing. It's like a box. And it uses your phone in conjunction with this box. So if there's cell phone access, it will use that. But if there isn't, it'll connect over satellite and let you send emergency messages, or you can send regular messages. And now this one I'll talk about the pricing for because it's so unique. For $4.99 a month, pounds, £4.99, I'm not sure what it is in the US, but under $10 a month, we can probably say, you get unlimited 24/7 SOS assistance. That means you can send messages anytime you want. It won't cost any extra to send the message. Again, the help may cost extra. But you can say, help, I'm lost in the woods. I'm standing next to my car. Someone come find me, whatever. It'll send GPS location, and they'll ask you questions. You'll start that procedure. But that's only $4.99 a month. That's not bad at all. Now, this is not a device that you can use by itself. You have to connect it with your phone, whereas the Garmin inReach is one device. So if you lose your phone or your battery's dead in your phone, this isn't going to help you. And with all of these, you've got something else that you have to charge. With this one, you have two things you have to charge. You have to charge your phone and it. But for the hardcore off-grid people, they have other plans that let you send regular messages. Like if you want to just chat with somebody, you can. For £10 a month, you get 80 messages for a month, which is more than enough to say, hey, sweetie, I'm okay. I'm sitting by the campfire. Everything's fine. You know, that's a perfectly reasonable thing. And then for £30 a month, you get 300 messages. And for $60 a year, or £60 a year, you get 250 messages per year. And honestly, that's probably where you should go. I mean, for £60 a year, you get 250 messages, which is more than enough to just check in periodically. And also get the 24/7 SOS assistance. So, I mean, I have not tried this thing, and it's just come out in the U.S., and it's coming out in the rest of the world. There are some countries you can't use it in because the U.S. has restrictions on accessing some of these satellites from places like India and Iran and Cuba and Georgia, the country, not the state, etc. So anyway, that's a pretty cool thing. And I'll have links to some of these things in the show notes if you want to try to find them. But this one is called Bullitt, B-U-L-L-I-T-T. I think if I were going to do this, I would be looking in that direction. I ran into number six, by the way. I ran into someone in the parking lot of Menards, where you save big money. And he was asking about my rig, because this happens when you're driving around an old ambulance. And he saw the antennas on my roof. I've got two antennas on my roof. One is just the regular radio antenna, and the other is it's an old VHF antenna for when this thing was an actual ambulance. And I'm actually using it with a CB. Don't tell any of the radio guys, because using a VHF antenna with a CB is bad and dumb, and you don't want to do that. Yet here I am. Anyway, he asked if it was a ham radio antenna, which was a little odd to me because, no, it doesn't look anything like a ham radio antenna. But he started talking about ham radio, and he said, oh, yeah, you should really get into ham radio and stuff. And I have friends who do ham, and I like that you can call anywhere in the world with a radio just about. But I never really saw it as a resource, because most of the time what I see people using ham radio for is trying to contact whoever's farthest away. They send each other postcards and stuff, but it's not like you can listen to music or the news or anything like that. But he pointed out something I hadn't considered, which is that if you can get a hold of anybody on the ham radio and say, hey, I'm in trouble, that person is likely to have access to a phone and they can call somebody for you or get help for you. And that made me think that, geez, you know, a handheld ham radio can also be considered an emergency device. So now, ham radio, you still need a license for. You have to take a test. It's from what this guy told me, it wasn't that difficult. It's not like you need to memorize Morse code or anything like that. But something to consider, if you were thinking about messing around with ham anyway, ham can also be considered an emergency device. Now, what happens if you don't have any electronics to help you out, you didn't plan well, or you ended up in a situation you just completely didn't expect, like you're driving down the highway and your car slid down an embankment into some trees and nobody can find you? What do you do? Well, first thing is make sure that you have a plan that if you don't arrive by a certain time, people will start looking for you. That's a very basic thing. But then it's good to know some basic emergency survival information. And I'm sure there are entire podcasts devoted to that topic. But a few things that are good to keep in mind. Number one, stay with your vehicle. Don't leave your vehicle. Don't try to go get help. Unless you can see help, like if you can see a city and it's easy to walk to, that's fine. But if you don't know where you are, absolutely stay with the vehicle, because what happens in a lot of these cases is they find the vehicle, but they can't find the people. And that's exactly what happened with this poor guy in Death Valley. If he had stayed in his vehicle at Goler Wash, somebody would have found him within a day or two, because that is actually a fairly well-traveled part of Death Valley. But because he wandered off, he's gone. So stay with your vehicle. Number two, conserve resources, and in this order. You want to conserve air, heat, water, and then food. Now, air, obviously, you've got 3 minutes to figure out your air problem. So if you're underwater, solve that problem first. So we can kind of get rid of that. One people don't always think about, though, is heat. You have to worry about heat. Heat is the next thing that's going to kill you. Lack of air is going to kill you first. Lack of temperature control is going to kill you second, whether it's too cold or too hot. do your activity when you're less likely to hurt yourself. If you're in the desert in the summer, don't do anything during the day. If it's the winter, don't do anything at night. That kind of a thing. Think about it, though. Think about your heat conservation, because it is a resource. And from there, it's water and then food. The old expression is, you can go 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food. That holds true pretty much. So think about those things. But very important, if you're trying to attract attention to yourself because you're lost, make three of anything that's visible. Three fires, three piles of rocks, three piles of leaves, three X's in the dirt. That is the international symbol for I need help. Yes, you see SOS written all the time, but three of anything is really what's supposed to attract attention to you. Three blows of a whistle, anything like that. So again, you should probably take some time to learn some of this stuff on your own, aside from a brief mention in a podcast. But I just want to introduce you to the topics. So there's some ideas for getting help when things go wrong. I'm sure there are many others. And if you have a really good one, go ahead and share it with me, and I will let folks know on the podcast. Thank you to everyone who has supported this program at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. You have made it possible for there to be no ads. And there are indeed no ads. If you would like to contribute to this worthy cause, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, and you can buy me a gallon of diesel, and we will continue down the road with no advertising on the podcast or on the YouTube version. Tech Talk. So last week's talking about electric cooking spurred some folks in the Discord channel to talk about microwaves. And one of my more popular videos on YouTube is about two different microwaves I was playing with in the van using different kinds of inverters and whatever. And I made an off reference to a specific kind of microwave that is good for vans. So let's back up a bit here. If you want to put a microwave in your van, you have to know a bit about how microwaves work. Most microwave ovens have an on and an off, and that's it. If you adjust the power setting, and it's usually from 0 to, well, maybe 10 to 100, you're not adjusting the power, you're adjusting how long it stays on. And you can actually hear this if you run the microwave. If you run it at 100, it'll make the same sound the entire time. But if you run it at 50%, half the time, it'll sound different. And it's just because they're kind of dumb devices. They really aren't doing a whole lot. But there is a brand of microwave ovens that actually does change the power because the circuitry is different. They're called inverter microwaves, and I'm very sorry about that because we think of inverters as a specific thing, but forget that for a moment. Fortunately, only one company makes them that I'm aware of. It's Panasonic. But if you look at a Panasonic inverter microwave, what it does is literally lowers the power, so it will cook at a lower wattage. And you might think, well, what difference does it make? The difference is that if you have a marginal electrical system, this is going to be a lot less draw. So let's say, I'm just throwing out numbers here, they're not real. Let's say you have a normal microwave, and it's drawing 20 amps. If you put it at 50% at 20 amps, it's going to draw 20 amps, stop, draw 20 amps, stop. And each time it gets to that 20 amps, it's going to do a surge and probably draw more like 30 or 40 amps and then go to zero. It's not a good way to draw power from batteries. It's a lot of stress on the wiring and the batteries, and you need a more robust system. With the inverter system, if let's say you want what would be 20 amps of cooking, well, you can set it down to say 10 amps and it'll stay at 10 amps the entire time. It'll take longer to cook, but who cares? We're not worried about the length of time in cooking here so much. We're worried about not making our system go into overload. So because of that, the Panasonic inverter microwaves are the best kind of microwaves you can have in a vehicle that's running a battery and an inverter. It's just the best kind of circuitry for your van. Now, that said, they're a lot more expensive. They tend to be a bit larger. They have electronic displays, which you'd have to reset every single time you turned on your inverter. And all that stuff might annoy you so much that you do what I did, which was to buy a really cheap, low-power microwave and then just run it off my inverter. And it's okay. So that's a choice you have to make. But I did want you to be aware that they were these special microwaves that basically cook different than normal microwaves. And they are the Panasonic inverter microwave. I will have a link in the show notes to explain those. Product review. Well, this is a product review that I never thought I would give. And here it is. Folks, I'm going to recommend to you a toilet brush. That's right. The thing you never knew that you needed in your van was a toilet brush. So, you know, we have toilet brushes at home, right? I mean, if you clean your toilet, you probably do it with a brush. I don't know. Whatever you do is up to you. But I have a toilet brush by every toilet in our home, which is currently two. And I wanted one for the Airstream. Airstream has a porcelain toilet in it, and you clean it just like you would at any other toilet in a home. And I wanted a little, you know, I just wanted a little toilet brush there so I could clean it. And what I ended up finding was a really nice, simple, easy to clean toilet brush that would work in vans very, very well. It is the Sellemer, Sellemer toilet brush. And it comes with a holder. And what's really nice about this is that it's very small. It actually collapses if you want to. You can unscrew the handle and make it really small. And by small, I'm talking about not much bigger than a deck of cards. And it comes with a holder. You attach it to the wall and you put the toilet brush in it. And it has a little thing at the bottom that helps dry it. And one thing that's really nice about this is it doesn't have bristles. It's flat and it's made out of silicone. So it can get in all the nooks and crannies, but then you can rinse it off and be pretty confident that it's clean because it's just basically little silicone knobbies. And because of that, I actually think it's ideal for van life if you're going to get a toilet brush for your van. Now, if you have a composting toilet, if you have a composting toilet, this is probably not what you're looking at because you don't want liquid to go into the bowl there, so you probably will have a different cleaning solution. But if you have a cassette toilet or if you have a black tank kind of toilet, this thing works great. Not only that, it comes in colors. Why, you can get rose gold or silver or white. Isn't that lovely? You can have it match. And yes, for the Airstream, which is all aluminum everywhere, I did get the silver because these things are important to me. Anyway, the good news is it's $12. It's not expensive. It's not going to break the bank. But if you've ever thought that you just wish you had a way to easily clean the toilet and something dedicated for it, well, take a look at this thing. It might help you out. Or it might be the most ridiculous product I've ever recommended, and we can just move on. Tales from the road. I'm almost positive I told this story before, but it's such a stupid story that I'm going to tell it again, and there is a little bit of a lesson here. So this is a don't do what I do kind of story. So let's see. I was driving a big truck in Boston, around Boston. Every morning I'd wake up, go to Chelsea, Massachusetts, and get a load of carpet, full rolls of carpet, in the back of my 26-foot box truck, and I would haul it off either to the Worcester, Massachusetts area or to Cape Cod. It was actually kind of a fun job. I just had to drive all day and listen to the radio. I liked it. In fact, when I kind of quit the job because I liked it too much. I was only 19, and I could see myself doing this job the rest of my life. And I was like, no, I think I want to do something else. So, anyway, I had some adventures on this job. And, well, I was 19 driving around this massive piece of equipment. And that's probably crazy now that I think about it. But at the time, there were so few drivers in Massachusetts that they were just desperate. And anybody who walked through the door with the right kind of driver's license, which I did have, they'd give a job to. And I was one. Yay me. I did not get into any major accidents or kill anybody, but that wasn't for lack of stupidity. And this one case, I had to deliver carpet to a warehouse. That's usually a pretty easy thing. And I backed the truck up to the loading dock, which is normal. And then what generally will happen is you'll back the truck up, you'll go in, this is before cell phones or anything, you'd go in and say, hi, I'm from Ben Elfman, which is the name of the company, I've got a load of carpet for so-and-so. And they'll say, okay, and they'll open the door, and you open your door, and then they will take a forklift and take the carpet out. That's the normal way. So, great. I get in, I say, hey, I'm so-and-so, and they're like, okay, we'll meet you at door six, whatever. I go back to door six, and I go sit in my truck, and I hear banging. Bang, bang, bang. Bang, bang, bang. I'm like, what the heck's going on? So I get out of the truck, and it was this fairly tall truck. It was every single time I got in and out of this truck, it was work. You know, getting out of it, I was worried about breaking my ankle if I did it wrong. And all day long, in and out of the truck was actually, it was a bit of work. I go back to the back of the truck and see what the problem is, and they're banging because I had forgotten to open the door to the truck, which is normally not a problem. It's not locked, and they will just open it for me. But in this case, they couldn't. And the reason was kind of stupid. What I'm supposed to do is pull up near the dock, open the door, and then back up completely to the dock. What I had done this time was just back up completely to the dock. Now, these are like garage doors on the back of the backs of these trucks, and the trucks are big. So when the door is up, there is a strap that hangs down so you can grab it to shut the door. What I had done by backing up with the door closed is pinch that strap between my bumper and the loading dock. So there was no way anybody was going to open that door without moving the truck. That's not the stupid part. The stupid part is how I decided to fix this problem. So you might think, being a rational person that you are, that I wasn't, you would get in the truck, pull forward a few feet, get out of the truck, and then open the door. See, makes sense, right? No. I, being clever 19-year-old, had a better idea. You see, this was a manual transmission truck. It had a stick shift and a clutch and all those things that Americans don't know what are anymore. But I did. I knew how to drive them. And I knew that if I put the key in the ignition and didn't start the truck, but just kind of bumped it, it would make the truck jerk forward if it was in gear, which it was. It was in first. So I was like, okay, all I have to do is, I don't have to climb up in the truck. I mean, it's a lot of work climbing up in the truck. So all I have to do is turn the key a tiny little bit, and the truck will jerk forward just enough to release that strap, and then they can open the door. Look how clever that is. Look how much time and effort I saved. I mean, it's just smart. God, I'm so smart. So I go up there, and I just bump the key a tiny little bit, and the truck lurches forward exactly like I thought it was, and then it starts. And then it starts driving away. And I am outside the truck, and the truck is driving across the parking lot, heading for the woods in which there is a river. So this is not a time when you have a lot of time to think. What exactly will you do? It's not like you can grab onto the truck and stop it. It's not like you have time to do anything other than get the heck out of the way. No, why would I do that? No, I've got to solve this problem. So I ran after the truck, and I was not behind the truck. Let's be clear. I was right at the front of the truck when this happened. I ran and caught up with the truck, but because it was so high to get into it, I couldn't actually climb in while the truck was moving. So I dove in and got my hand on the brake and stopped the truck. And because it was a manual transmission and I wasn't pressing on the clutch, that stalled the truck and stopped it. I did manage to save the truck without causing a whole lot of trouble. It didn't smash into anything. And believe it or not, nobody saw me do this. I don't know how I got away with that. But after that was over, I was just like, boy, that was really dumb. And then I got back in the truck and did it the proper way. So, lesson here, folks. Don't do that. Very few of you are probably driving manual shift vehicles anyway, but never turn the key unless you're sitting in the driver's seat. This seems like a very basic thing that everybody should know, and heck, I probably knew it too, but climbing up in the truck was just too darn hard. A place to visit. Okay. This place is Boston, okay? But it's not just Boston. This place is Scandinavian Boston, although it's a little bit more complicated than that. Did you know that the Viking Leif Erikson sailed up the Charles River in Boston and founded a community called Norumbega? Yeah, nobody knew that until the late 1800s when basically this guy invented it. Out of whole cloth. His name was Eben Horsford, and he decided that the Vikings must have thought that Boston was Vinland, which we now know as Newfoundland, up in Canada. you can go visit this stuff. It's kind of amazing. If you are in Boston, and there are little clues to this all over the place. For example, the Longfellow Bridge, which is the famous bridge across the Charles River right downtown. It goes over to Cambridge. Has Viking ships holding it up. Seriously, look at the way it's constructed. The abutments are Viking ships. Some of the buildings downtown are decorated with Viking shields. There is a big statue to Leif Erikson, which doesn't make any sense in Boston other than people believing the story. And in fact, there are a whole lot of plaques and signs indicating where Leif Erikson's house was and stuff like that, all out in Weston, which isn't too far from Boston. It's just west. Weston, get it? Yeah, okay. They've even claimed to have found old rune stones out there. One of them is very interesting, actually, but most of them, they're just rocks with scratches on it, because runes, if you look at runes, they're very angular, very simple shapes, and it turns out that if you run a tractor with a plow over a rock enough times, yeah, you're going to get some runes. Anyway, this is kind of fun that you can actually go visit Boston and look for this stuff. And I'll have a link in the show notes to a whole bunch of the different things that are explained and where you can look for them. And it's from this website called ScandinavianAggression.com, which I just love the name of this. But it turns out there's quite a bit of stuff there. What's the real story? The real story is actually a little bit more interesting. At the time, in the late 1800s, there was a lot of Catholic immigration happening in Boston. Now, if you're alive today in the U.S., you are aware of the issue at our southern border. And this wasn't that different. People were concerned that the Catholics were coming in and, what was the phrase there? Poisoning the blood of our country, or something along those lines. Yes. And the Protestants of Boston were kind of upset about this. So they would do things to kind of claim Boston as a Protestant place. And thus began the war of the Vikings versus Christopher Columbus. These were the signs of which side you were on. So if you're Protestant, you would support all the Viking stuff because the Vikings were Protestant, being from countries that are mostly Protestant. And then the Italians and Irish were the pro-Columbus people because Columbus was Catholic. It's a big, long, complicated, bizarre thing. And one of the things I noticed going through southern New England is that any time there's one of these Viking statues to Leif Erikson or whatever, there's almost always a Columbus statue a few blocks away. Very unusual time in history, and, you know, everybody's got to have somebody to hate. And in the 1800s, it was the Protestants and Catholics, and vice versa. I don't get it. Y'all can just fight amongst yourselves, but it's kind of a fun thing to do if you're in Boston and you want to see something a little bit different. Or, if you've been to Boston, you were just wondering, why the heck there's this Viking dude dressed like Robin Hood standing on a pedestal there? So, I'll have a link in the show notes, but watch out for that Scandinavian aggression. Resource recommendation. So I had an incident, and I don't want this to happen to you. I was using my phone as a hotspot. I hooked up my computer, and I was just doing Facebook or something. It was very light stuff. And I got a text message from AT&T saying I had used up all my hotspot minutes for the month. And I looked, and it was like I was into day three of my cycle, and there's just no way I could have done that. But knowing that something was up, I shut everything off, and actually what I did was I connected to a different hotspot so that I wouldn't have to worry about it. And I did a little bit more work, and boom, another text message from that hotspot. You have used 50 gigabytes of data. And I'm like, how is this possible? I'm just doing Facebook. Well, it turns out that what was happening was that since I hadn't used my computer in a while, it was connecting to Amazon Photos and uploading all the videos and photos I had made in the last 6 weeks or so. And that's a lot of data. I mean, every video I've put up on YouTube is 4 gigs or 5 gigs. It just did it in the background, so I couldn't even see it. I had no idea it was happening. But there is a way to stop this automatically. And this is just a safety measure. Any device that you have that you're going to connect to, any device that has a limit, like if your hotspot has a 50 gigabyte limit, or your iPhone or Android device has a 15 gigabyte hotspot limit, whatever that is, make sure that all the devices that connect to that are in low bandwidth mode. Now, on the iPhone, you can go into settings and search for low bandwidth mode, and it will tell you how to do that. Basically, you're going to go to the Wi-Fi connection and press on the little I for information, and you'll see a checkbox there for low bandwidth mode. What that does is it turns off all background activity, or at least most. It turns off anything that's going to have a big download. Your apps will stop updating. Your background photos will stop going up to the cloud. All that stuff will stop. And ever since I've done that, I haven't had any trouble with this. So I'm sure Android has the same thing. It's a setting for each individual Wi-Fi connection. So for mine, when I'm home and I have unlimited bandwidth, I have the setting turned off. But when I'm on the road and I'm connecting to any of my hotspots, I have those set to always be low bandwidth. This can save you a significant hassle if you've ever experienced suddenly running out of bandwidth for the month. It's a little panic-inducing, so make sure you check that out. Folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 206. I am recording this before the eclipse because I'm going to be traveling, so I don't know if folks had a successful eclipse or not, but I sure hope you did. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, and if you need to get a hold of me, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember these wise words from the Havamal, which is a Viking text. Moderately wise a man should be, not too crafty or clever. A learned man's heart, whose learning is deep, seldom sings with joy.